sky's so blue. The birds are singing, I got nothing to do. Hey, hey,
hey, hey.
Mm, it's a sunny day.
Sunny day now.
My pocket's empty, my cupboard's bare. But call me illogical, I just don't care. Hey, hey,
hey, hey.
It's just a sunny day.
Hey, 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 it's a sunny day.
It's just
day.
A sunny day.
Yeah. Hey.
It's the KSL Greenhouse. Expert tips for flowers, trees, gardens, and soil. Our hosts are Maria Chaleos and Tawn Bettis on KSL News Radio.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse. We'll be taking your calls and questions in just a few minutes. The number to call, 801-575-8255. You can also text us your questions at 57500. I wish it was a sunny day, but it's not a sunny day today.
It was raining on the way in this morning.
It looks like it's going to taper off, though, so I might get my tree planting done, hopefully.
I don't have to worry about that, Dave. He said snow Monday.
I know. You're headed to warmer climates. Good for you. You need a vacation. As long as you're back by next week.
I'll be back.
Our listeners are like, you're not going to leave Maria by herself, are you?
It's a short one. Okay. I'll be back Thursday night. All right.
We're starting the morning with the plant of the week, and it's the dwarf iris. These kind of mini irises, I adore them. They are just so cute when they pop up, you know, in the spring, and they don't have the thick foliage of their adult partners.
No, these are iris that are native to Iran, Iraq, Russia, and they bloom a month earlier at least than many other iris species.
Yeah, I haven't seen any yet.
No. And so they are one that are used for massing, almost like you would use crocus or some of the small tulips, to where they're better used in groups. Mm-hmm. So they're commonly used in woodland settings along ponds, or sometimes in more formal settings. I don't know that I'd use them as a border, but sometimes they're mixed into a border with other flowers.
My only complaint about them is they just don't last long enough.
No.
They are such beautiful little flowers, and they're very short-lived.
Yes, and so the name of this dwarf iris is often times called reticulated iris or netted iris because of the flowers. And they have a pretty, what I would say, a standard iris flower, but there are variations on it to where sometimes you can find varieties that are more lavender colored. There are other varieties that are a violet blue, and then some have a mix of the lavender, violet, blue, and then some yellow highlights in them. And so there are several cultivars out there, or varieties available, that you can mix up.
Right.
So buy three or four varieties together, mix them in the same bed for some added variation.
That gold central stripe, though, on a lot of those just really has those little, they really pop in your flower bed. You really see them. They stand out.
Yes, they do. And so you can actually purchase these. They're usually available as in the bulbs in the fall, mixed in with tulips and the crocus and other, you know, spring blooming bulbs. I've seen hyacinths out lately that were really pretty. And so they need to be planted in the fall. Once in a while, you can find them in a pot in the spring or summer and just plant them already established in a pot. You know, they're not super widely available, but you can find them.
I have to say the ones that I have planted in my courtyard are from a big, huge planter that my husband bought me years ago that was just full of these and those little mini daffodils. And I just, you know, I just transplanted them, put them outside.
Yeah, and they do just fine. And I read up on these, and depending on the fact sheet, one horticulturist recommended planting them on 4-inch centers. And you don't need to line them up by like soldiers, but if you're putting them, massing them in an area, that 4-inch spacing would do it. But then another recommended 1-inch spacing. And I think that the 1-inch spacing, iris have a tendency to stop blooming when they're overcrowded. And so I think on 1-inch spacing, it would be spectacular. But within 2 or 3 years, you'd be lifting them out of the ground and spacing them out. So I almost would prefer 4 inches. For myself, just so I don't have to dig them as often.
Yeah, they're not very fast growing, though, I've noticed.
No, and they will produce little bulblets or baby bulbs or whatever you want to call them around the base, but the babies they produce can take 4 or 5 years before they bloom.
Yeah, and unlike the bigger variety, these are bulbs.
Yes.
And not tubers.
Yes. And so they will be something that you put in, and you put them in some place that's just going to be left alone because they are slow spreading. But they, like you said, they are beautiful when they bloom. And it's nice to go out in the spring if you have a water feature or an area that you like to sit, you know, in the afternoon when it starts to warm up a bit. They're beautiful.
Right. They're really great along the walkway as you're coming into your home. Someplace where people are going to see them even when it's cooler. Maybe you're not sitting outside.
Yes. And some of them have a nice fragrance. Some of the iris species almost to me smell like grape Kool-Aid.
Okay.
The
I
scent.
I can't say that I've ever really smelled them, but okay.
Well, if you could smell how grape Kool-Aid
I can imagine
tastes,
what grape Kool-Aid tastes.
But they have a pleasant fragrance. And then the other thing with the netted iris or these dwarf iris is that they're actually shade tolerant. And so you can put them, they still need 5 or 6 hours of sunlight a day, but they do just fine on an east exposure or under shade trees as long as it's not deep, dank shade.
Mm-hmm. Any other special conditions that they require?
No, they like to dry out a little bit in the summer. They still will need supplemental water. And so they can be a part of a water-wise yard in shaded areas to give you some spring blooms. Other things to be a little cautious about it, like all iris, they are poisonous. And so you don't want to
plant them where the little toddlers are going to be.
Yes, you're
going to
pull them
right?
up and things. They taste really bad, I'm assuming. You don't hear a lot of people trying to eat iris, but that would also make them deer-resistant.
But they're worth noting. They're worth planting in a very showy place where people walk up to your
yes,
house.
Yes, they're very worth
spending
it.
A lot of time.
I wouldn't plant my whole yard up in it because you'd have a good spring show and then nothing.
Right.
But areas with these in there are very worth doing.
Okay, anything else you'd like to mention about them?
Just look for them in the fall.
All right. And again, we're talking about the dwarf iris or the iris reticulata. And you can find out more about these on the KSL Greenhouse Facebook page. We're going to take a break, come back with your questions and calls. Phone lines are open at 801-575-8255. You can text us 57500. Good morning. Thank you for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse. Maria Chaleos, Ton Bettis with you, taking your calls at 801-575-8255. Phone lines are open right now. It's a good time to call, or you can text us at 57500. Do you think the rain is discouraging people from wanting to go out in their yards?
It always does a little. I mean, on a rainy Saturday, if my kids don't have sports, it is a day to sleep in, read a book.
Well, that's the problem.
Yes.
They're sleeping in. Anyone who follows me on Facebook knows that I'm planting some pretty large trees. We're doing a more water-wise park strip, part of a re-landscape of the north side of our house. And yesterday I started to dig down, and I've learned a few things in the last day that I'm going to share with you. Dig down to put in these very large trees. So I measured the root ball exactly where you told me it needs to be buried. And if anybody didn't hear your advice about tree planting, they can go back to the Facebook page, and there's a really nice article that's written on it as well. You can hear all about that. So I had to dig 17 inches down, 27 inches diameter to make this root ball fit in this hole. So I'm digging along. It's pretty easy because it's kind of moist right now until I get down to that 17-inch mark, and I find 4 inches of road base left behind by the crew. Probably some 30 years ago when they put in the subdivision, right? And I used a lot of naughty words trying to pick through that stuff.
They compact it.
Oh, and it was like there's nothing that's going to grow through that road base. No wonder nothing along that park strip ever grew very well.
Yeah, and road base can be tough, but when you put trees in parking lots and similar situations, in these little islands, that's one of the reasons trees really struggle. And many times I see in homeowner situations because of our sprinkling systems and we fertilize the lawns and different things, the trees do okay in those situations, especially if you have a good 17 inches of topsoil. but it is so miserable to plant in, especially if you don't have a commercial tree auger that's augering your holes out and things. And it does get very difficult.
Yeah. My question for you is, though, so if I've hit that at 17 inches down, and that's pretty much where that root ball is going to sit, and you said don't dig it any deeper, but yet I've found road base, then what is the best advice?
Well, the tree roots will grow not maybe through the road base, but they will go sideways. And if they can get under the sidewalk into regular soil, then they would focus on rooting there. And because this is a waterwise situation, you have to have irrigation. But as those trees get bigger, you were probably going to, because they're not going to be growing under the road mm-hmm. for water, they're going the other way. You're probably going to eventually need some gridded or inline drip pressure compensating so that it waters evenly, so that you can get it out there to keep the trees watered.
Okay, so I don't need to dig any deeper than that.
Stick
with that depth. But what about, should I be digging wider knowing that there's still that road base in that first few inches?
More so that you can get the tree in the hole positioned how you want. You're going to have room to cut the wire basket off from the tree, have room to stake it, and, you know, do everything you need to do. And so if you've got a good 5 or 6 inches at least on any side of the tree, then that's just going to be easier to work with the tree and get it how you need to and get everything that needs to come off of the root ball, you know, the burlap, the wire basket, the twine.
Mm-hmm. But I cannot worry so much about that road base. The roots will maybe grow above that.
Well, roots will come out sideways from the root ball. They don't go down initially because when those trees are handled, you know, they're dropped on the ground. And so trees also don't root out like pictures show where you have an equal canopy under the soil like you do on top. The roots stay in the top 18 inches to 2 feet of soil. And so because the roots actually go more sideways, then digging that hole a little wider will loosen the soil a bit and give opportunity for those roots to punch through. But over a period of 4 or 5 years, in search of nutrients, those roots will go under the sidewalk to where you have other, when I say bare ground, not covered up by road, and those will be the areas that you focus on fertilizing and watering.
Mm-hmm. So your best advice for folks actually digging the hole when they do, I know that I'm not alone in this. I know that a lot of subdivisions are just like this. When they have to dig through something like that, your best advice is?
To hire a professional. Well, there's some things you can do. You know, I think one of the best things that do-it-yourselfers can do is to rent power equipment from Home Depot, Sun Rentals, wherever.
I might do that today. And one hole was bad enough.
There is a piece of equipment that a company, and there's several companies now, but the original company was called Dingo, and it was a little mini skid steer, or you know, just almost like a bobcat. It is a stand behind, and it's only 2.5 feet wide, and you can get them either with a scoop bucket or a bucket that you would trench with, just almost like a little mini excavator. But if you can learn to use one of these, you can actually dig your holes with a Dingo. And the things that are nice about the Dingos and the similar equipment is you can fit them through gates. You know, because a bobcat, you could never do that, but these mm-hmm. Dingos will go right through. And so they're commonly used for building small ponds and water features, digging tree holes and things of that nature. But even then, I will get a good drill, or I'll get one from Harbor Freight with a warranty, and get what's called a bulb auger. And the bulb auger is about 2 to 2.5 inches wide. And you've got to be careful with them because if you get them stuck, they will whip around a little bit. And so you have to hold them securely. But the bulb auger, I will just run through 6 inches, you know, 4 or 6 inches, and work my way through the soil with it. And it loosens the soil and it makes it easier to pick and dig out because you're using electric power. Mm-hmm. And so I don't actually use my bulb augers to plant bulbs. I use them to dig holes.
So it's bulb.
B-U-L-B.
Yep. Oh, okay. Not bowl. Bulb.
No. Yeah. Bulb auger.
That's,
I was born in a barn, so sometimes I slur my speech. I'm not drunk. I'm just born in a barn.
No, it's just sometimes your brain fills into, like my brain
says. No. And so you can pick these up off Amazon. Hardware stores and garden centers often have them. They're a little more common in the fall, but they're $15 on Amazon. And as long as your soil is not rocky, they can be your best friend. The other thing, and it may not help with the road base, but because I have really clay soil and it's rocky, mm-hmm. and it has rocks that are up to 6 inches wide, and those you just have to work around. But what I will do, you know, I was out a couple of years ago planting some trees, and the soil was a little bit dry, and I'm just going for everything I'm worth. You know, you talk about using naughty words, digging that hole, and my wife comes out and says, "What you doing?" It's like digging holes, and I was all grumpy. And she's like, "Why don't you put water in them and let it soak in and dig them tomorrow?" And so it works. I dug the holes about 6 inches deep, filled them with water, went out the next day, and it was just a different world.
Right.
The rocks came out easily, and I got them dug to the depth they needed to be. So that's some of my suggestions.
Right. So speaking of water, it's raining right now. Is it going to be too wet for me to actually dig these big
holes?
You
have clay soil,
the soil's
really sticking to the shovel, it's too wet and it's mucky. You can ruin your soil structure. But if the soil is moist and for the most part, the dirt isn't sticking to the shovel, it's fine.
Okay. As long as it's not sticking to the shovel, you're good to go.
Yes.
Okay. The other thing I learned is that you should shop around for T-posts, especially if you're putting in like 5 trees, because
yes,
the price varies very distinctly from a farm store to Home Depot by $2 or $3. And if you're buying 10,
it's a big difference,
right?
It is.
You know, if you're just buying a couple and you're going to go to the most convenient place, right? You're not going to drive around town, but
no,
it's worth doing a little search around on that. I did that. It's like $2 or $3 difference. So
yes,
things you learn when you're planting trees.
Yeah. I mean, and it starts to add up when you're re-landscaping, and $30 and $40 here, if you can get that savings over and over, it's really convenient.
All right. Number to call with your questions, 801-575-8255. You can text us 57500.
The Greenhouse Show on KSL News Radio.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse. Maria Chaleos, Ton Bettis with you. We're taking your calls, and the phone lines are open at 801-575-8255. You can also text us at 57500. We have been talking about tree planting, and before we took the break, we were talking about T-posts that you pretty much have to put on the sides of those new trees, especially when they're larger trees when you plant them. And Tom, they have to stay in the ground for a year.
They do. So on especially bald and burlap trees, because the wire basket comes off once the tree is in the hole, you cut it away. A lot of the support the tree would have from that wire basket and the twine wrapped around the trunk is gone. And so if you get a strong windstorm and the trees are not secured, they can blow over in the wind. And so you stake the trees from two sides for 1 year to allow those roots to grow into the soil so that it can defend against blowing over in the wind as it gets older.
So those T-posts are put in at the same time, at the same depth that you are planting the tree.
You actually can dig off to the side. I would dig the holes a good 6 inches deeper than the tree hole, just to get the posts in so they're more secure.
I'm going to have to dig deeper. Are you kidding, Tom?
This is where the bulb...
This took me 2.5 hours to just...
This is where the bulb auger comes in handy, because you can just use the bulb auger.
Oh, okay. All right.
So...
Bulb auger to get through the side of those. Okay,
yes.
I'm going to go buy one today. There's just...
They're
no
a good tool. And they need... If Bob has a good drill, mm-hmm. that's a good hammer drill, that's a Milwaukee or a Makita, a good company, it won't burn the bearings out. But if you're using like a Walmart Black and Decker,
you're in trouble.
You'll burn your bearings out. So you do need a good drill to do it, but they are wonderful. So the posts have to go in, and you put them in either straight or on a slight angle away from the tree.
Yeah, why a slight angle?
That just adds some strength as the tree goes back and forth. If it's on an angle, the tree, if it pulls the post a little bit, it's going to straighten out more than just get pulled towards the tree. And so we always put them on a slight angle. And you found it used to be that the ponderosa treated posts that you would see on trees were less expensive. But right now, metal T-posts are way less expensive than the ponderosa treated posts.
They're green or gray, and they look nice. They don't,
Yeah, and so you were finding that a lot of times our independent farm stores they're far less expensive.
$2 to $3 less.
Places
per
like
post.
Steve Regan, IFA, than the box stores.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so they stay in a year. But
they
then
do.
How do you get them out if they're digged
so
that deeply?
If, you know, you learn why the original cursing people were farmers because they would dig and things, but digging T-posts out with a shovel is a new level of punishment.
Plus, doesn't it hurt the roots of the tree?
It can, because you have to dig a wide hole. And even when you get most of the way down, those posts can stick in the ground. And so there's a couple of different things you can do to get them out of the ground. If you have a jack, like you would use for a pickup truck, that is a tall jack that ratchets up, you can put those and wire that to a T-post and just pull it out that way. Mm-hmm. Wiring it can be a little bit tricky, but it's very doable. But you can also either rent or purchase what's called a T-post puller. And it looks like these truck jacks, except for it is, instead of being ratcheted, it's a lever. And the lever, you connect, and the lever's long enough that you just push the lever down and those T-posts come out, and it's just slick. It takes under 2 minutes to pull one out of the ground.
Oh, that's
And so if you have 10 or 15 or 20 T-posts, for the $80 or $90 these things cost, if you can't find one to rent to me, it is worth every penny. And then you just put it in your garage, and it's one of those tools you may not use again for 5 years. But once you have try to dig T-posts out without a jack or a T-post puller, it's a nightmare. And they just come right up out of the ground with these T-post pullers.
Right. And then the other thing is that you have to tie the post to the tree. So describe kind of the options you can use. We talked about this, and you said putting a rag up against the tree. And
if you're using
give
rope.
Us the options.
So if you have rope or baling twine, you can use that to secure the tree, but the first thing is you don't ever tie knots around the tree trunk, mm-hmm. because it may girdle the trunk. In a year, it probably won't, but it can. And as that tree moves, if you have a loop that's knotted on the trunk, it's more likely to score the bark, which you don't want. And so you always loop the rope around the trunk and tie to the T-post. But if you're using rope or twine especially, you need to get an old cotton cloth and wrap it around the trunk and then put the rope or twine around the cotton cloth to the T-post. Now, there are kits available that use straps instead of rope, and the straps are usually an inch to an inch and a half wide, and they have grommets in them, that then you can wrap those grommet or wrap the strap around the tree and then use the grommets to tie off to the posts so that you have a wider surface area and they're less likely to do damage to the trunk.
And they do look nice too, by the way.
They look a lot more professional. We're going from kind of not really sloppy looking, but definitely homemade. I used what I had, mm-hmm. to a more professional look. And I actually like the tree staking kits that you can get with these straps in them, because there is less potential for them to damage the tree.
Okay. Russ is on the, well, before we get to Russ, one person was saying about the posts, you can use post pounders. It's much easier to get them in as well.
Yes. And if you have not been doing upper body strength training, your muscles will be jello the next day.
Mine are kind of sore already. Okay. Russ is on the line in Murray. Good morning, Russ. What was your question this morning?
Good morning. Yeah. I have a couple questions. Just one, my lawn seems really lumpy. So my first question is, why do we have lumpy lawns? And then second question is, how do we get rid of them, the lumps?
Well, there are all sorts of reasons why we get lumpy lawns. And so let me ask some questions. Did you plant your lawn yourself?
No, it's an older lawn.
Okay. It's an older lawn, so that helps. And then have you ever had your soil tested?
No, I have not.
Does it seem to be pretty clayey in texture to where if you took a ball of moist soil and rubbed it between your hands, could you make a ribbon several inches long?
No, I've dug in it and it doesn't, it's pretty sandy. I mean, it's not
fantastic.
Clay-y.
Okay. So I suspect I was wanting to eliminate the lawn from being overwatered and forming clumps like that because of earthworms, because of compacted or clay soil. And I suspect the lawn is just old and it has separated out a little bit, and you may have rye or fescue forming little mounds or clumps that are growing faster than the rest of the lawn. So here's what I would do.
Okay.
Have you looked at your thatch also to see how much thatch you have underneath the grass?
Yeah, when I've dug it up, it's pretty thick. I mean, I've taken out because I've planted trees and a couple things.
So there's more than a half of an inch of thatch.
Yes.
Okay. So here's what I do. I would get a lawn dethatcher, and you can get a blade for $25-$30 and put it on your mower. You might be able to rent one, or you can get on Amazon and get an electric one that you pull backwards. And I would dethatch the lawn, and if you get a mowing type, set it a little lower so that you can knock those clumps down. The other thing I would start doing is aerating and see if you can loosen that up and get rid of some of the thatch, because it does sound like there might be some compaction in there or other things. Now, when you water, do you allow the water to the lawn to dry out between irrigations?
Yeah, I do. Because the most I ever water is like every other day, and sometimes it's only twice a week.
Okay, good. Good. So allow the lawn to dry out a little bit, but see if you can even it out with the thatching and just maybe not really scalping it, but those clumps, if you have a blade on there, you'll really kind of level them out a little bit with a dethatching blade.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks so much.
All right, Russ, thanks for your call this morning. Next listener, Ton, is wondering if it's time to put pre-emergent down, and will that hurt their two-year-old bushes that they planted, like Rose of Sharon and Lilacs?
No, it won't hurt anything. Do not put the pre-emergent down and cover it with mulch, because that will. And so the pre-emergent always goes on top of the mulch. But it'll be fine, just because the roots are underground and the pre-emergent stays on the soil surface.
Next listener says they're 28, new to gardening. Are there some community classes that they can take to start learning the basics?
There are, depending on where you live. Central Utah Water has several online classes that are free that you can register for on their website. Weber Basin Water offers several classes. It looks like Conservation Garden Park this year was mainly just doing water conservation oriented classes instead of general vegetable gardening. It could be they already taught them, but I would check the Water Conservancy District. So Weber Basin, Conservation Garden Park, Central Utah would be the three. And then some of the local extension offices are also offering gardening classes.
Okay. We are going to take a break, come back with your calls and questions. Number to call, 801-575-8255. You can text us at 57500. Good morning. Thank you for spending your Saturday morning with the KSL Greenhouse. Maria and Ton with you, taking your calls and questions, 801-575-8255, or you can text us at 57500. Next listener, Ton, wants you to share your thoughts on hydroponics. And then I'll share my thoughts. You don't do a lot of hydroponics.
No, it's for a homeowner, it's a hobby. You're not going to break even. And, you know, on a larger scale, even where you see hydroponics be more common are places like Alaska, northern Canada, to where it becomes more expensive to ship fresh food in than it is to just grow it in a greenhouse in those cold climates. And so it's fine. There's science behind it, works, but it's just something that, especially on a small scale, you'll get enough for a salad or something, but it's
exactly
not
exactly what I've found. Mm-hmm.
But it's not anything that I wouldn't count on supporting my family with it.
And you don't want to do that through the summer when you can grow it so easily in the ground, and the hydroponics take more time, but it's a really clean way if you're like allergic to some of the things that are found in soil. We've had, you know, people call us about stuff like that. There's a reason to do it, but it takes a lot more time.
Yes, and on a
very small
larger
scale,
let's say you built a greenhouse trying to do hydroponics, you have to monitor the water because there's small amounts of fertilizer in the water to keep the plants going, and you have to monitor it if it's the levels are getting too low or
too high.
Yeah,
you can't just set it and let it go.
You're monitoring sometimes the pH of the water, the salinity, just all sorts of things, and it becomes almost like monitoring a hot tub.
It's kind of a fun winter hobby.
It is. But if there are kits you can buy, and Maria has a desktop kit.
I have a couple.
Looks like it came off the Star Trek Enterprise.
I need something in the winter.
Starship Enterprise.
Yeah. You know, it works.
Yes.
Yep.
And so they're fun.
All right. Gary is on the line in West Point. Good morning, Gary.
Good morning.
What was your question this morning?
I have a 100-foot lilac hedge, common lilacs. And the last few years, there's been some of them started to fade out, and I couldn't figure out, I couldn't see any sign of borers, but I'm getting some black on the bark. And when I look online at lilac diseases, I can't find anything that matches what I have. And I'm just wondering what it might be, what kind of disease and what it could do to maybe take care of that.
How long have the lilacs been in the ground?
Probably 20 years.
Okay. And are they just kind of dying a stem at a time?
Yeah, there's just some dieback, not the whole plant, and then sometimes they come back. But yeah, the leaves are kind of fading smaller.
I suspect that they get some various root rot diseases in them. When you get them between about 20 and 30 years old, it becomes more common, and there's nothing you can do about it once it's in the lilac, unfortunately.
Okay.
And so if you start to have them fade, and I know it kind of ruins the look of the hedge, what you may need to do is yank the dead ones out and go in with a different shrub. And so maybe you could turn this into a mixed hedge of similarly sized bushes, to where you could go back in with some Rose of Sharon here and there. And so you had spring lilac, summer Rose of Sharon. You might be able to get some Golden Privet or some Cheyenne Privet to go in there. But the lilacs just do that after 25 or 30 years sometimes. And there's no cure for it.
Okay. That's what I was wondering, if it was just age related. So,
yeah, I grew up in West Point, and when I was there, it was still mostly farms, and to see those old houses through there, it just brings back a lot of fond memories. I apologize that your hedge is struggling. The only other thing you could try doing is maybe going in with some fertilizer now, and just get lawn fertilizer and walk on either side of them and just spread it out just like you would for your lawn, and see if that stimulates some new growth. But that's about the only other thing.
All right, Gary, thank you so much for your call this morning. We are about to break for the top of the hour news. We'll come back with your calls and questions. The number to call, 801-575-8255. You can text us at 57500. If you're just tuning in and you missed the plant of the week, this morning at the top of the 8 o'clock hour was the dwarf iris. And you can find out more about that on the KSL Greenhouse Facebook page. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about controlling weeds using lawn pre-emergent, something people are asking a lot of questions about this morning. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
Never seen the sky so blue. The birds are singing, I got nothing to do. Hey, hey,
hey, hey.
It's a sunny day.
Sunny day now.
My pocket's empty, my cupboard's bare. But call me illogical, I just don't care. Hey, hey,
hey, hey, hey.
It's just a sunny day.
Hey, 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 it's a sunny
it's
day.
It's just a sunny day.
Yeah. Hey.
It's the KSL Greenhouse. Expert tips for flowers, trees, gardens, and soil. Our hosts are Maria Chaleos and Ton Bettis on KSL News Radio.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse. We'll be taking your calls and questions in just a moment. The number to call, 801-575-8255. You can text us at 57500. Top of the hour feature here in the 9 o'clock hour is something that's on a lot of people's minds, weed control, pre-emergent, and really getting the season off to a good start.
We are. I had to turn on my mic.
It's so important.
It probably is. At any rate.
I can't reach it, so you have to do that.
Yes. When pre-emergent time comes around, a lot of people start calling, actually in February, saying, can I just do this? And I would wait if you're trying to do it in February because it's just too cold and nothing's actively growing. The ground is too cold also. And so I got blindsided a little bit this year because the forsythia started blooming over a week ago where I live in Santa Quinn, and we are colder than most of the Wasatch Front. And so it's been blooming for at least a week to 10 days across the Wasatch Front. And that's one of the indicators that it is time to put the pre-emergent down.
You see those beautiful yellow flowers. It's time.
It is. The problem with the forsythia is it's still a bit early, but it's within the ballpark. And so we just tell people, because a lot of people are familiar with it, to just put it down when the forsythia is in bloom. But the actual best time to do it is when the forsythia is done blooming and the lilacs are just forming flower buds. And so we're getting out in the, not the pun not intended, out in the weeds a little bit here with timing. And so what I like to do is just get a soil thermometer or a kitchen thermometer and stick it into the soil in a few places. When the soil temperature is around 47, 48 degrees, 50 degrees, that's a perfect time to put the pre-emergent down.
So why is that the perfect time?
Well, when the grass hits about 55 to 60 degrees, the crabgrass starts to germinate. And so it'll still be another 3 or 4 weeks. Looking historically over the last 4 or 5 years, March has actually been a little warmer sometimes than April. And we've been really stormy through April. And when the soil reaches about that 50-degree mark, it's going to be 55 degrees within a few weeks. And you need to get that pre-emergent down and have those granules break down in the product a little bit to be effective. And so that's getting down just in time so that you have the maximum effectiveness against crabgrass so that that product lasts the most time it can. So many of the pre-emergent products for crabgrass are going to be a 60-day product. And if you put that down in early March, late February, even though the temperatures are cooler, you've lost some of that time.
Mm.
And that's why we like to wait for some time when the forsythia blooms to about tax day in April 15th to put that pre-emergent on the lawn.
Is it something everyone should do?
No, it's not. If you have to use a pre-emergent, then you need to ask yourself, what's wrong with my lawn? Because a healthy lawn outcompetes most of these weeds. Now, every lawn's going to have a few, but a few weeds doesn't justify a pre-emergent. And so the other thing that they need to do some research on is, are the weeds in my lawn going to be controlled by a pre-emergent? Because if you have weedy grass right now in your lawn, it's not crabgrass. It's a fescue or a barnyard grass or something else, because crabgrass is annual and it grows during the hottest part of the summer. And that's why it doesn't start to germinate until soil temperatures are around 55 to 60 degrees. And it's at its worst through July and August. And so if you have weedy grasses right now, the pre-emergent's not going to help you. If you have field bindweed, a pre-emergent is not going to help you. And so you really need to know about what weeds you're going after to really have something that's going to be effective. And so what I like to recommend people do is, if they have crabgrass or foxtail or other weedy grass problems that are annual grasses, is go ahead and use pre-emergent, but figure out why the lawn is struggling and try to remedy those situations. You know, are you mowing higher? Do you need to fix your irrigation system so it waters more evenly? Do you need to aerate more often? So we need to start looking at why the lawn is unhealthy so that we don't have to use a pre-emergent.
So if they have some of these other problems, some other types of grasses not affected by the pre-emergent, is this the time still to be treating those with whatever they find that they need to be using?
It depends on what their particular problem is. You know, if it's field bindweed, you know, the morning glory, it is not blooming or germinating or coming, breaking dormancy right now. And so it will start to in mid to late April through May. And when those, stems are about 6 inches long, the actual best at treatment for them is a spray of something containing quinclorac, which would be like Image all-in-one lawn weed killer, or maybe there's a few others out there, Q4 Plus. And so you really need to know what weed you have to know what you need to apply to control them short term. But then what plan are we forming so that we don't have to keep reusing these every year?
Right. A healthy lawn will prevent a lot of weeds.
It will. And the other thing about pre-emergent is that if your lawn is in need of fixing or repair, pre-emergent is going to take you down one particular path. And what it will do is help prevent a lot of, you know, weeds that are germinating, but you cannot resod or reseed those areas for sometimes a calendar year, but you need to read the label on the product. And so if you're trying to repair the lawn, pre-emergent may not be your best option because it prevents everything from germinating, not just weeds. And then the other thing to consider is that, let's say you have a lot of spurge, and most of the pre-emergent products that you're using are intended for crabgrass. And so you may need to switch up products if you have broadleafed weeds.
All right. Anything else you wanted to add?
No, and it gets a little confusing sometimes, but with some research and trying to figure out why you have the weeds, you can save yourself a lot of time and money.
Right, it's expensive.
Because right now at the farm stores, a bag of pre-emergent mixed with fertilizer, the going rate's $50 to $60.
All right. And you've put up a really great article, or Michelle has put up a really great article on the KSL Greenhouse Facebook page as well, talking about weed prevention that you can check out. We're going to come back with your calls and questions. Doug is up next, then Jared. Number to call, 801-575-8255. You can also text us your questions at 57500. Thank you for spending your Saturday morning with the KSL Greenhouse. Maria Anton with you, taking your calls and questions. Doug has been waiting very patiently on the line in South Weber. Good morning, Doug. What was your question this morning?
Good morning, Maria and Tom. I've just been hypnotized by the pennies from heaven dropping and wetting all the gardens and everything. It's a wonderful morning. So anyway, just a part of that segment with the pre-emergent, I do have a question on that in application timing. I've done pre-emergence before and stuff like that, and you know, the cost of it is pretty high, and so I've transitioned over to a professional agency that's doing it. But the question I have is, they also indicate that they can do aeration by way of chemical, is there such a thing like that? Because that, they don't bring any machinery in.
It's just a surfactant, and it lasts. There may be ones that last longer. It's a surfactant that lasts for several weeks, and then you're back to square one. It doesn't actually do anything to improve the soil. It just uses something chemically similar to a dish soap that breaks up the surface tension and tension of water and helps it penetrate a little bit more deeply into the soil. And so it's a poor replacement for actual aeration, hollow core aeration.
Yeah, I got a Ryan core aerator, so I'll probably do that every other
year.
You
are so
like that,
much farther ahead doing that than using a chemical aerator, which is really just a surfactant, every time, because you're actually pulling those cores out of the soil. And as those holes naturally fill back in, the soil loosens and it pulls thatch out that then breaks down and introduces soil particles into the thatch layer that also breaks it down more quickly. And these chemical aerators are just not going to do that.
Very good. Now what I really called you about, if you have time.
Yeah, really quick.
I do have 150-foot length back of my yard. I'm really looking to, because townhouses are projected to come in, looking at columnar spruce as kind of a block and then break patterns. I need about 20 feet. Is there anything else you can recommend?
Oh, there's all sorts of things. Any columnar evergreen that you plant, so juniper, spruce, pine, may need to be wrapped in the winter to keep them from splitting out. And the spruce are highly susceptible to that. The columnar ones, you know, they work well in Portland and Seattle because they get very little snow, but because of their branch angles, if you don't wrap them, they can split and it ruins the form, but they will work. Are you wanting a permanent one back there? A permanent screen?
Yes, because I just wanted to block the townhouses, but still, I want to see the mountains.
You could use Emerald Arborvita. Those will maybe need to be wrapped, but they're really common. They may be less expensive. There's a lot of them around. They do well here. There are some columnar junipers, several varieties, Skyrocket, Taylor, that will get anywhere from 3 to 6 or 7 feet wide, depending, and they would be water-wise. And some of the slightly wider junipers may not need to be wrapped if they were going to get 6 to 8 feet wide each. Columnar oaks would be a little more expensive, but they wouldn't be a total screen in the winter, but they would be pretty. There are several types of columnar conifer that you could use.
Very good. Is it time to plant Walla Walla onion sets?
Get them in as soon as you can. The reason the bulbs get so big is that they're very day length dependent, and because their day lengths are increasing, the plant grows its bulb big. So as soon as you can get them in, I would.
Thank you so much for your show. Wonderful.
Thanks, Doug, for your call this morning. Next listener, Ton, wants to know, they have a peach start, probably started from a pit that's growing kind of in a barbed wire fence, and they're wondering if they can actually transplant it.
Yeah, I would dig it. And if it's starting to dig it as quickly as they can, otherwise wait for fall. But the peaches will probably be really good, but they'll likely be clingstone.
Okay. Next listener says they have a forsythia that's loaded with solid yellow blossoms. Another one 20 feet away. There's nothing. Help.
There's nothing you can do. Plants do this sometimes. It could be pruning. It could be. There's a lot of different reasons. And the only thing they can do is be patient and wait for next year.
Okay. Jared is on the line in Morgan. Good morning, Jared. What was your question?
Good morning. Yes. I have a question regarding some strawberries. So I have a small strawberry patch. Last year at this time, we still had probably 2 feet of snow over the top of them. And I went out last year and uncovered them, just dug the snow out from around them, and they were green. And they did really well all last year. And then in the fall, I was worried about another big snow year that we were potentially could have had. So I did a little bit of research on what to do to protect my strawberries through the winter. And from the University of Minnesota, I found that I ended up covering them with about 2 inches of hay or straw as an insulator. And now I don't know what to, I mean, do I go out and uncover them now? I don't have any snow. All my snow is gone. And I've kind of looked up underneath the hay, and they are green. The strawberries are green, so I just don't know. Do I uncover them now?
You could give it another week or two, just because Morgan's a couple of weeks behind the Wasatch Front.
Yeah, and I am going to probably get some snow again in April.
And it's not that the snow will hurt them. It's just the snow is a great cover, and the straw is, because the strawberries are actually not that cold hardy. And if they get exposed to temperatures in the teens, that can kill the tops, and then it may kill the patch out. To get that straw off, you can carefully sift through it, but a leaf blower, if you had, not on the highest setting, but you may be able to get the straw free using a leaf blower too.
Okay. And then about thinning them, when should I thin them out?
When they're done producing fruit, take about a third of them out every year. Any plants that is 3 or 4 years old comes out.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right, Jared. Thanks for your call this morning. Mm-hmm. Connie would like to know. She said she had both goo on her low-grow sumac and shotgun fungus on her quazon cherry last year. And she wants to know if she should treat one or both of these this year, and when and what, if so.
I don't know what the goo would be on the Grolo sumac. If it's on a branch, I would prune it out. But shot hole fungus is best treated right when the blossoms drop from the quazon cherry. She can use a fungicide. But when the leaves are dropping in the fall, when about half of them are off the tree, you treat it with a fungicide then, too.
Next listener wants to know, when should they do a soil application of chelated iron for their raspberries?
Now.
When is the earliest that they can plant outside geraniums and petunias in the Utah Valley?
May.
You got to wait a little bit. Carol is on the line in Centerville. Good morning, Carol. What was your question this morning?
I've got this cherry tree that in this home that I just bought, and I was excited to have cherries, and they blossomed last year, and they turned into little green cherry about the size of a cherry pit, but they never got any bigger. And they had like a tiny little red skin of fruit on them, but they just never turned into real cherries, and they're nasty too. Is this something that I can fix, or should I chop the cherry tree down?
We may need to hold you through, so I need to ask some questions. Okay. One, do you know that it is a fruiting cherry?
I don't. It's been speculated that this little housing development was raised on what used to be a cherry orchard, because like tons of these people have cherry trees and nobody has anything else. And they're all right here when you bought the house. So I assumed that it was.
Because it could have grown up from rootstock, which would dictate that the fruit's not very good, or it could have been a seedling. And if it was a hybrid between different cherry species, that could also do it. And so how is it being irrigated?
Just with the sprinklers.
Okay. And does everybody else's cherries have good fruit on them?
Yeah.
So you probably either have a rootstock that came up or a seedling. And if it doesn't produce good cherries, I would consider cutting it down and just planting a new cherry tree.
Okay. It's a big tree. Does somebody need that cherry wood for something amazing?
Maybe. I mean, if the birds will pick the cherries off, I suppose. And if it's not producing usable cherries, if it's providing shade or something, but it's just one of those situations that is probably not going to produce good cherries if this year, especially. I'd give it one more year, and then if it doesn't, then make your decisions.
All right, Carol, thanks for your call this morning. We're going to break. 801-575-8255, the number to call, or text 57500.
The Greenhouse Show on KSL News Radio.
Good morning. Thank you for spending your Saturday morning with the Greenhouse Show. Maria Anton taking your questions, 801-575-8255, or you can text us at 57500. Next listener has a couple of follow-up questions, Ton. They say they had an arborist come and recommend a crooked tree, pruning for this crooked tree, and training a new leader. And they're wondering if that's going to work for a crooked tree.
Maybe. Without seeing the tree, I can't really say.
Kind of hard to tell them that.
I mean, you can train a new central leader up into a tree, but I just, without seeing the tree, it's really hard to say.
Hard to know. Okay, and then they're saying they're looking for an Oregon grape, but what they've found doesn't look like theirs, but they're wondering, they're saying theirs is over 50 years old, so it probably wouldn't look like theirs, right?
There may be some differences. There are three main Oregon grapes available. There's standard Oregon grape, which gets 8-9 feet tall. It's evergreen, and the leaves kind of turn a plum purple in the winter. Then there's dwarf Oregon grape that gets 5 or 6 feet. And then we have creeping Oregon grape that gets anywhere from 6 inches to 18 inches and forms a ground cover.
So they may be looking just a totally different.
Yes, and so there's three options generally. And then every once in a while, you'll run into Fremont Oregon grape, or Mahonia is another name for it, which looks like a holly. And then there's others even that you run into very sporadically, but the main three are creeping Oregon grape, dwarf Oregon grape, and standard Oregon grape.
Okay. Next listener wants to know, does a mulching mower and not catching the clippings, does that add to the thatch buildup?
It does not add to the thatch buildup because the grass blades are chopped so finely that they quickly break down. In fact, if you mulch your lawn clippings back in, you can skip one fertilization a year because it adds that much nitrogen back to your lawn. Now, if you're leaving a trail of grass clippings behind you, then it can add to the thatch layer, and you would want to bag the clippings for a couple of weeks in May until the lawn slows down a little bit. Mm-hmm. What I will do during that time of year is collect my clippings, but then they go into my garden to help conserve water and keep weeds down. And as soon as when I mow and I'm not putting a trail of grass behind me, I just mulch all the grass back onto my lawn.
And those clippings don't get grass seed in your garden?
No. Even if the grass starts to form seed, you mow it often enough that the seed doesn't mature.
Okay, just interested in that. Next listener wants to know, how and when should they use Preen?
When they need it, and in the spring sometime.
It goes in the flower beds.
Yes, and I would read the labels because Preen's good for many weeds, not for others. One not labeled is spurge, and so they may need to use something different. But generally anytime in the spring, but you want the beds to be finished, everything planted. If you're putting mulch down, get it down, and then the last thing you do is the pre-emergent, and it never goes under the mulch.
Okay, the next listener says they put down Preen 6 weeks ago. Will that help with weeds during the summer?
It depends on how long the Preen lasts, the soil type. You know, they may have put it down.
I'm sorry, I misheard that. Oh. If they put Preen down again in 6 weeks, will it help with weeds during the summer?
Yes, it would, but they need to look at their label to figure out how often they need to put it down.
Okay. This next person wants to know, can they dethatch or aerate after they put down the pre-emergent?
No. It'll break the barrier the pre-emergent makes, and it'll become ineffective.
Okay. James is on the line in Bountiful. Good morning, James. What was your question this morning?
Yes, I had a question regarding what would make a good screen, kind of a privacy screen. I live off of Bountiful Boulevard, and it's probably around 5,500 feet. And it's kind of a bit of a hollow. We have a lot of natural oak and maple trees. So there's in the summertime, there's a fair amount of shade. And I'm just wondering if there's any kind of a good shrub or bush that would be, that would make a good screen in that type of environment.
Do you have deer in your yard?
Oh, yes.
Many of the shrubs that you probably would want to plant that are broadleaf evergreen are going to be deer candy.
Oh, yeah.
You may as well just put Snickers and Milky Way signs above the bushes.
Oh, no.
Because they'll just tear them up. And so privets maybe. There's a lot of different shrubs that deer feed on And did you, with that shade component, that makes it a little bit challenging, because if you can't keep the deer away, many of the deer tolerant, or the deer, the shrubs that are shade tolerant, are fed on by deer. Now there are yews, it's spelled Y-E-W, so something like maybe a Hicks yew or others that are a needled evergreen that are shade tolerant, but if the deer get really hungry, they will feed on it and it kills them, because a lot of our toxic plants have precursors to cyanide and they get in the digestive system and then are converted by the acids in their stomachs. And anyway, so that's a tough situation. How tall do you need the shrubs to get?
Oh, I was just looking at something that could maybe get up to maybe 4 to 6 feet. About okay. The only natural one that I see out there is some type of a holly shrub that kind of grows wild.
But, there's dwarf Oregon grape holly, which is more of a bush. It's very closely related to our native creeping Oregon grape. And so dwarf Oregon grape might actually be one you could use. It gets five or 6 feet tall. It can be hedged a little bit. There's also, they may not get quite that tall, but we have the coral berry, which is very shade tolerant and very beautiful too. It has a purple berry on it.
Coral berry.
Yeah.
Coral, you say that's a type of holly?
No, coral berry is not a type of holly. There's snowberry and coral berry, which are completely different shrubs, but they fit your size constraints. And then the Oregon grape holly, the one I would use is the shrub, but it's the dwarf Oregon grape holly.
The dwarf. Okay. Okay, super. Well, no, those are some great ideas. I'll check those out, and those could very well do the trick.
All right, James. Thanks so much for your call this morning. Next listener, Ton, says they're getting ready to sod their backyard, and they've been told about a different kind called Desert Sage, sold by Chanshare. They say it uses 30% less water. It's supposed to look like bluegrass. Do you know anything about it?
Yeah, it probably will. It's just they're using Kentucky bluegrass varieties that are a little bit more drought hardy that may have some fescue in it.
Would you advise them getting?
I think
it
would be fine. It's going to be more expensive. They could call their local conservancy district and find out if they wanted to do it from seed. Then there are several companies marketing a water-wise turf mix that looks and acts like bluegrass, but that is also 30% more drought hardy than Kentucky bluegrass.
Okay. Next listener says they planted a wireless alcova last year that came tied to one stake. Should they take that out now?
I would.
Okay. We're going to take a break. When we come back, Rod, you'll be up next. Number to call with your questions, 801-575-8255. And you can also text us at 57500. Good morning. Thank you for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse. Maria and Ton with you, taking your calls and questions. Next listener is in Clearfield, Ton, and they say they've had great success growing jalapenos and other hot peppers, but they've been having a hard time with the Carolina Reapers, and they're wanting to know if you have any tips for them.
If I would start them early under grow lights and get them going, a lot of these peppers, the habaneros, but these really hot hot peppers require probably 180 to 200 growing days. Mm-hmm. And so what I'll have people do is grow them in pots. And then if they haven't ripened yet, sometime in late September, bring them into a greenhouse or something similar and continue to grow them in the pots so that they ripen sometime in mid-October.
Next listener has purchased a couple of elevated cedar garden containers to grow their vegetables in. Is it safe to put linseed oil inside the bed to protect the wood? And if not, what would you recommend to protect
the
wood?
Linseed oil is fine.
Okay. Next listener is Rod in Salem. Good morning, Rod. What was your question this morning?
Good morning. We're still struggling with our burnt orange maple tree. It's 30 feet tall now, but the one just 50 feet from it is green, and this one is yellow. We've tried we use Save-A-Tree, and we'll treat next week with the chelated iron. But I remember last year you mentioned a few additional things. I can't remember what they were, so I thought I'd better call back.
Well, I would do a number of things because the maples can have nutrient deficiencies besides iron, including zinc, manganese, and magnesium. And so what I would do is make a brew with your chelated iron. And so you're going to get the chelated iron, and then you are going to get a liquid nitrogen fertilizer, some even like Miracle-Gro, and you're also going to get a liquid humate and then liquid micronutrients. And so you've got your iron, your humate, your liquid nitrogen, and liquid micronutrients. And you're mixing this all together in 5-gallon buckets of water and then just drenching it under the tree into the soil.
That sounds good. Also, last year, for the first time, that poor thing, the covering over the trunk split. I've reattached it, but what does that indicate?
Sun damage, winter sun damage. If it's on the south or west side, those trunks need to be wrapped in the winter until they get the really deep, corky bark.
Yeah, it's 14 years old, so it's pretty, very good.
What maples do. It's unfortunately a lot of the maples that have orange or red fall color, whether it's Norwegian sunset, Pacific sunset, whatever, they have just really thin bark. And in our dry, arid climate in the winter with the intense sun, the bark splits unless you wrap them.
Rod, thanks for your call this morning. Next listener says that they had grasshoppers overtake their flower garden last year. They're wanting to know how you feel about EcoBrand. They tried a bunch of things and whether there's a more budget-friendly option.
Until you can get neighborhood-wide control, no matter what you do is going to be marginal. And so they can try it, but until they get the neighbors to do it, and if they're next to fallow fields or on the hillside and can get treatment in a broader area, anything they do is just going to be, you're always behind the eight ball with it. And so they could try the EcoBrand, and when the grasshoppers first start coming out in the fall, in the spring, and they're small, is to get that kind of stuff out. But if they know that the grasshoppers are attracted to certain plants, then those are the plants that they would maybe spray. You know, in a vegetable garden, it seems like they like the marigolds better than other plants, and so you might plant trap crops. But download USU's fact sheets on grasshoppers to get some suggestions. But on a single yard basis, it's just very, very difficult.
Okay, I'm going to try and squeeze Sage in here. Sage, good morning. What was your question?
Well, I was dropped on my son off at a basketball camp last year at BYU, and it had a tree or a hedge line of fragrant bushes. Do you know what those are?
I have no idea. When were they blooming?
It would have been like June, early June.
Early June.
But it wasn't necessarily a bloom. It was just a fragrance. Man, it was amazing.
You know, there are a bunch of linden trees that it could have been. The lindens have a nice fragrance because there's a ton of linden trees on BYU's campus. Early June is just a time, unless they had some lilacs in proximity, but that's too late for lilacs. It's too early for butterfly bush. It's too late for a lot of the viburnums. And so my best guess would have been maybe linden trees that were in proximity. Yeah, because if you didn't see any blossoms, it was likely linden.
Okay, and it's a tree, not a shrub.
It is. And so you can look those up because anything else, I mean, Canada Red chokecherry and spring snow crabapple, sometimes I have a nice fragrance, but those are more of a May bloomer.
Right.
Even April, so.
Perfect. Does chili pepper really get deer away from your tulips?
It can. You have to spray it after every rainstorm, but it definitely can. There's some homemade mixes you can look up online or just buy it commercially.
Okay. We have just a minute before the top of the hour news here. Ton, a couple of aeration questions. Best time to aerate and when and how often should they aerate?
Late April through mid-May. Usually once a year is fine. If a lot of lawn traffic on a clay soil, twice a year.
All right, we're going to take a break for the top of the hour news. Number for you to call, 801-575-8255. You can text us at 57500. When we come back, following the top of the hour news, our top of the hour feature in the 10 o'clock hour is pruning roses. A lot of people have been very excited to prune roses, so they're really getting into it. If you're just joining us, our plant of the week was the dwarf iris, and you can find out more about that on the KSL Greenhouse Facebook page, as well as the top of the hour feature at 9, Controlling Weeds Using Lawn Pre-Emergent, a great fact sheet for you. And remember, you can always catch us in podcast form at kslpodcast.com.
Never seen the sky so blue. Birds are singing, I got nothing to do. Hey, hey,
hey, hey.
It's a sunny day.
Sunny day now.
My pocket's empty, my cupboard's bare. But call me illogical, I just don't care. Hey, hey,
hey, hey, hey.
It's just a sunny day.
Hey, 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 it's a sunny day.
It's just a sunny day.
It's the KSL Greenhouse. Expert tips for flowers, trees, gardens, and soil. Our hosts are Maria Chaleos and Ton Bettis on KSL News Radio.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse. We'll be taking your calls and comments in just a moment at 801-575-8255. You can also text us at 57500. Well, finally, people have been asking us for months whether they, well, not months, how about weeks, about whether or not they can start trimming their roses, and finally it's time that they can do that.
It is. The last couple of weeks it's been time to prune the roses, and I would get it done sooner than later.
Okay, so what are the tips? Where do we make those cuts?
With pruning, you always start with the dead and diseased wood, and by this time of year you should be able to see by bud formation especially where the dead and damaged wood is, and that just comes out. That's the first thing you do.
Mm-hmm.
Look for anything that might have cankers or look diseased, and then that comes out also. Then you take a look at the rest of whatever it is you're pruning. And because there's different types of roses, you need to look at them individually on how that group would be pruned. And so Floribundas, Hybrid Teas, Grandifloras are all pruned similarly, to where you, after you get rid of dead and diseased wood, you take out anything that is really weak and wispy, and you want to leave about 4 or 5 main canes that are going to be pruned, depending on the age of the plant, anywhere from knee height to maybe thigh height.
Okay, so thigh height would be those that have been there for a couple decades.
Yes, and you leave that amount there because the pruning, because these will bloom all summer long, you prune them really hard to make them generate a lot of new growth, and they produce flowers off of the new growth.
All right, so you should always prune them in the spring.
You should. You do not prune roses here in the fall. In other areas of the country where it remains warmer, you know, California, coastal Oregon, coastal Washington, it's not as important if you prune them in the fall, just because they don't get cold enough for the roses to be damaged as nearly as much as they can be here. And so that's why sometimes when you read gardening guides, if you're not careful about the area that it's written for, you can run into problems.
Is there one thing that people do wrong when it comes to pruning roses, things that you see commonly?
Sometimes the main things are that they oftentimes don't take into account the kind of rose they're pruning.
Mm-hmm.
And if, let's say, you have an heirloom rose that only blooms once a year, one of the older bush roses, or even some of the heirloom, if you're growing bourbon roses or whatever, they only bloom once a year, and if you prune those in mid-March, you've lost your blooms. And so it's knowing the kind of rose and when it blooms. And so if it only blooms once a year, you prune it right after it's done blooming, because those new flower buds for the next year are going to be formed within just a week or two of the old flowers dying back.
Right. I like the pictures that we have in the article that's up on the KSL Greenhouse Facebook page for you to check out. How about things like the climbing roses, though? How are they? Because they're different. They are.
And so there are ramblers and climbers. They've kind of differentiated them. And if they only bloom once a year again, you prune them back right after they're done blooming. so that they can generate new growth for next year. And so you just cut them back how you need. But the ever blooming climbing roses are pruned again in mid to late March. And what you're going to do is you have your main structural canes, and then you have side branches on those, and you prune those back so that each side branch has about 6 to 10 buds on it. And what this does is it leaves enough of the buds there to regenerate, but it causes them, especially in the spring, to give you a lot stronger flush of blooms in late May to early June.
Most of the roses that I have bloom more than once. They bloom throughout the summer, but they don't like the hot temperatures.
They will slow down.
Yeah, slow down.
So temperatures above 90 slow them down. And so summer pruning, especially on the hybrid tea roses, is imperative to keep them going. And so what you will do is, as soon as you see on a hybrid tea the flower is spent, you follow the stem back to the first set of leaf, this first leaf with 5 leaflets. And so the roses, it looks like each little leaf is a leaf, but they're actually leaflets. And when you are at your first group of 5, you prune it at that point, and within a month or 6 weeks, it'll rebloom. And so that's how you keep the hybrid teas going through the summer. Now, there are many new bush roses that just bloom profusely, especially in the spring and fall, but even through the summer. The Knockout series is one. The Medialand has a few of them. But a lot of these newer bush roses only get 3 or 4 feet. And so because they are ever blooming in the spring, you use renewal pruning and just take out 20 to 25% of the branches toward the base of the shrub. You want to wear a good thick jacket and leather gloves because they have thorns. But if you take a third of the roses out, 20 to 30%, and then just give them a light haircut, that will keep them blooming most of the summer.
The thick jacket is imperative. Long sleeves don't do it. I mean, I always look like I've been in a cat fight.
Yeah.
Those scratches.
A leather jacket or something that is the thick canvas or something that the thorns cannot go through.
What is the life of a rose bush? I'm going to say my roses, most of them have been in for 30 years.
Roses in Utah last quite a while just because we have fewer diseases here that would hit them. Say in Louisiana, Mississippi, you're lucky to get 4 or 5 years because they're so disease prone in those climates.
Because of humidity.
Humidity, yes. And so it's very common for roses here to live anywhere from 10 to 50 or 60 years, depending on the variety. Some of the old fashioned roses that only bloom once a year can oftentimes live for 50 to maybe 100 years old.
But you're making me think, though, I should check out some of the newer roses to see
what
I'm missing.
There are so many good roses out there. Some of the newest shrub roses, especially, are really low maintenance, fairly disease and pest resistant. And besides just giving them a general haircut in the spring, they're wonderful.
Yeah. What about special prune? What kind of pruners do you use when you're trimming rose bushes?
I have a pair of loppers. I use one of 2 or 3 companies' pruners. I like a company called Bacho. It's BAHCO, and they're a French company. And they build contractor-grade pruners that everything is replaceable and hand shears. Then another company called Felco, which is a Swiss company that I like them even better than Bacho. And so I love Felco pruners. And then the third one is one that's a little less expensive but really good called Hickok. The only place I've seen them are at IFA.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to add?
That's about it. But look up some fact sheets on rose pruning. We have a great one. It's not difficult once you start reading a little bit about your roses, but you'll just increase your blooms incredibly if you do some pruning.
Yeah, and there are great pictures on this fact sheet that we put up on the KSL Greenhouse Facebook page. So if you're wondering about those 5 leaflet leaves that Ton was talking about, you can see those specifically. We're going to come back with your calls and questions. Gary, you're on the line. You'll be up next. Number to call, 801-575-8255, or you can text us at 57500. Good morning. Thank you for spending your Saturday morning with us, the KSL Greenhouse. Maria and Ton with you, taking your calls, 801-575-8255, or you can text at 57500. Gary is on the line in Bountiful. Good morning, Gary. What was your question?
Good morning. I have two quick questions. I have Weber water, and I assume that that's what's bringing in some clover and what I've been told is oxalis. And I haven't had real good success being able to control that. Any suggestions?
Well, there's not like an evil henchman that's dumping oxalis and clover seeds into the irrigation. You know, it's down the line somewhere. It actually comes in through the wind, comes in through contaminated plants, contaminated seed. But the clover and oxalis isn't native and isn't coming in from wildland areas. The seed's probably being blown in, though. So okay. As far as products that will do a good job at controlling that, anything that contains triclopyr, and so that's spelled T-R-Y-C-L-O-P-Y-R, so triclopyr. And so there is a product made by PBI Gordon called T-Zone that has it in there that you could try that seems to do. You may need to spray again for a couple of years in the spring and fall. And so are you out in the wind or something? We're getting a lot of feedback on your phone.
So go ahead, Tom. I had him bring it down so you okay. could actually answer his question without hearing the wind.
Yeah, so the T-Zone is one, but other products containing triclopyr would be another one, would be Turflon ester. But the triclopyr does a pretty good job against clovers and also the oxalis. But he would also probably want to use a pre-emergent containing isoxaban, which used to be sold as Gallery or Galleria. There's many of them out there.
All right. Gary, are you still there or did we lose you?
No, I'm still here.
Okay, good.
Second quick question. I have raspberries and the kind that bear in the spring and in the fall. And I really haven't done anything in terms of fertilization, and they seem to be doing fine, but is there something I should be feeding them with?
No. If you're getting good production and they're healthy, I wouldn't do a thing. Sometimes fertilizing okay. them can actually reduce the fruit load.
Great. Thank
right,
you
Gary,
very much.
Thanks for your call this morning. Next listener, Ton, would like you to talk about Bermuda grass a little bit. They say they know it's used in some places. If it has infested the lawn, is the only way to get rid of it to kill it and dig it out?
No, I actually wouldn't dig it out. There's a few products. That Turflon ester I just mentioned is registered for Bermuda grass suppression mm-hmm. and eventual control. And then there's another one made by Bio Advanced, which is formerly Bayer, but it is called Bermuda Grass Control. It just got us a really straightforward name. So you need to find somewhere that carries a lot of the bioadvanced products, not knowing where they're at, you know, J&J Nursery, maybe IFA or some of the other local independent garden centers.
Yeah, so their intense root system makes it not a great idea to
Yeah, and
them
when
out.
You pull them, especially if they're not dead, every time you fill a pop as you're pulling that Bermuda grass up, you've just created a new plant.
Oh, my.
They can then start sending out the runners.
Awesome. Next listener says, if the Glacier tomato seed packet says 56 days to maturity, is that 56 days from the transplant date or from germination?
It's just a general thing. It's not going to be 56 days because it just isn't. So once you seed those, in theory, it's supposed to be 56 days after seeding, but temperatures have a lot to do with it. You know, if it's too hot, too cold. And so the soonest we usually get tomatoes, especially if you start them 6 weeks ahead, put them out in mid-May, is going to be mid-June. You can do some things to make them earlier, you know, walls of water sometimes and some other things like that. But usually mid-June, that's going to be the absolute earliest, and it's usually into July.
What is saltgrass?
Saltgrass is just a... it could be a lot of things.
Well, this person says they've struggled with saltgrass in their flower bed for years. How do they get rid of it once and for all?
Unless they live in an area with really salty soil, I don't know that it would be there. But there's an alkali grass that's really common in areas with really salty, strongly alkaline soil.
And how do they get rid of it?
Just a general lawn weed, not lawn weed killer, but just a general grass killer or Roundup.
Okay, will that kill the other thing? Well, Roundup will kill everything.
But if the soil's salty or really alkaline, and it is alkali grass can be very aggressive.
Next listener wants to know, what's the best way to get rid of raspberries to replace them with a different variety?
Spray them out with Roundup. I would let them grow a little more, make sure that they're dead. But they don't want to go in the same exact place they had them before. If they have room, just make a new bed somewhere else, because you get a buildup of diseases in the soil that can impact the new plants fairly quickly.
Okay, next listener wants to know when they should overseed their lawn this spring.
They can do it now. Birds may get some of the seed, but usually anywhere from mid to late April.
Okay, Carolyn is in Erta. Good morning. What was your question this morning?
Yes, we have been getting lawn area ready for seeding, but there's a lot of weeds. If I spray the weeds out, is that going to hurt the seed germination?
No. If you use something like glyphosate, like a Roundup product, as long as you wait the period of time, which is generally around a week, that seed will germinate just fine.
All right. Thank you.
You're certainly welcome. Thanks for your call today. Next listener would appreciate some recommendations for columnar apple and pear trees that do well on Salt Lake's East Bench.
I don't know of any columnar pear trees. There is a series of apples that are columnar that I am finding. I've been looking desperately for dwarf fruit trees.
Mm-hmm.
Everywhere is sold out. And So I might have to wait for next year and order sooner. But colonnade apples, or they're just simply sold as columnar apples. Stark Brothers is one place I have ordered from in the past for a lot of dwarf fruit trees, but you can sometimes find them Lowe's, Home Depot, and local garden centers.
What is the best time and way to prune a Japanese maple?
The best thing to do is to not prune a Japanese maple. If you must, just follow the limbs back that are the offending limbs and either prune them back at a branch intersection or at the trunk. But the more mature the Japanese maple is, the more of a risk of getting an internal rot disease at the pruning cuts. And so you need to be careful.
Okay. Number to call with your questions, 801-575-8255. Phone lines are open. You can also text us at 57500.
The Greenhouse Show on KSL News Radio.
Good morning. Thank you for spending your Saturday morning with me and Ton. You can give us a call right now. Phone lines are open at 801-575-8255 or text us at 57500. Getting back to our text questions, next person says they have a 50-year-old lawn. No matter how they fertilize, the grass blades grow long and skinny. And if they let the grass grow long, the blades lay down and start looking like colics. They're wondering if power raking and then overplanting with bluegrass is a good idea.
It sounds like they have annual bluegrass. Hmm. That's exactly what annual bluegrass does.
Oh.
And
so that's what the lawn is supposed to do.
Well, annual bluegrass is, for the lack of a better comparison, if Kentucky bluegrass was Jimmy Carter, annual bluegrass would be Billy Carter.
Oh, boy.
So annual bluegrass is a weed. And yeah, so if you're not over the age of 50 or 55, you won't get that. But the annual bluegrass is just, or if you've ever seen Twins, annual bluegrass is Danny DeVito, and Kentucky
back,
bluegrass
you?
Is
didn't let it go.
No, is Arnold Schwarzenegger. So it's just not a great turf grass because it lays down, it's disease prone. But sometimes it's what you got. It's really common in shaded areas and also areas that have compacted soil that are overwatered. And so what I would do is look at the soil and see if you can fix the soil and maybe improve your drainage, dry the soil out between irrigations, but it's probably going to need to be killed out in those areas if they want to get rid of it and reseed it or resod it. And then once the grass is established, they're most likely going to have to use a pre-emergent in late summer because it germinates in the fall and early spring to see if they can keep it at bay.
Hmm. Okay. Next listener says, how long do they wait after applying a pre-emergent to put down lawn seed?
you have to read the instructions on the pre-emergent. It's anywhere from 60 days to a full calendar year.
Okay. And next person wants to know, what depth do you check the soil temperature?
I will stick this thermometer, because they're usually only about 6 inches or mm-hmm. 5 inches long. I just plunge it in, but you want it a good 3 or 4 inches into the soil.
Next person wants to know, is it too early to put root stimulator on their trees, like the Chanticleer pear, sycamore fruit trees?
There's no reason to put root stimulator on your Chanticleer pears. It doesn't work unless there's some new product, but you know, if they're going to do anything, the trees have been in for a while, maybe some fertilizer, they're going to get a lot more benefit out of fertilizer, because root stimulators that you can purchase are usually pretty marginal.
Next listener has a tough one for you, Ton. What vine would be good to grow over a white vinyl fence? Their back fence borders a schoolyard. They want to protect the fence from the kids, and the kids are always kicking it.
Boy, unless they can plant something on the side facing the school, it would be something that they would almost need to put a secondary fence in to keep whatever they were growing protected until it was up to size to protect the fence. But I'm looking at maybe barberry bushes, because they're thorny and they might stay out of that. They could, and unfortunately there are not any dwarf.
Is there a liability to planting something like that where you know that there are school children?
I don't know.
I'm just curious.
Maybe. Maybe if a kid fell in it and got all cut up and there were medical bills, or could be.
Hmm.
You know, and so they could just do a shrub, you know, something that's very fast growing would be something like the golden privet would be one they could plant that will grow 2 or 3 feet a year. They could maybe do some Isanti dogwood, because it grows a couple feet a year, and it would give them a good 3 or 4 feet, you know, away from the fence. The kids couldn't get to the fence after a while, and that might keep them from kicking it. But
well, the bigger question is, why do they like to run through them?
The bushes?
No, the vinyl fences.
Oh, they're kids.
Our poor neighbor just finally gave up and put up something that there was no possible way for anyone to run through.
Yeah, I mean, chain
link.
She
replaced it like 3 times.
Yeah, we have a horse breeder out in where I live that has these vinyl picket fences, and one of them is adjacent to a road that has a pretty serious slope on the edge of it with mm-hmm. no shoulder. And he quit fixing it, because there's every year 3 or 4 cars slide off and ruin the fence.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
But I mean, I think something that isn't thorny, that is fairly fast growing, I would look at golden privet, or maybe Isanti dogwood or a variegated dogwood. Those will go 2 or 3 feet a year, and I'd plant them every 3 feet.
Okay. Next listener is having problems with not dog urination, but dog traffic, just picking a spot in the lawn that they're traversing. I'm wondering if there's anything they can do to strengthen the lawn.
They can try a turf grass called dog tough turf, but they would have to take out a section of lawn. It's a Bermuda grass that I'm not so sure is actually illegal to grow, because it's a hybrid. And the way the noxious weed list reads, it doesn't ban it.
Hmm.
And it's not as aggressive. And so there's a movement trying to get some of the hybrid Bermuda grasses decriminalized or legalized here. But the dog tough turf might be one they could try. But if they plant it in their bluegrass, it will overtake the bluegrass.
Wow. Next listener would like you to go over the pre-emergent and aeration a second for them. They say once the pre-emergent is applied, then they cannot aerate?
No, it will break the barrier, unfortunately. And so if they need to, I would aerate now, even though the lawn's not growing at its fastest and best.
Mm-hmm.
And then after they aerate, put the pre-emergent down.
Okay. Audra wants some insight on growing strawberries indoors. The variety that she's trying to plant is Alpine strawberries, if that makes a difference.
My honest advice would be why.
Because she can.
But the problem is, it's really hard, and it's almost because I can't. The strawberries are just not an indoor plant. You can start them if you have a greenhouse.
Yeah, I'm wondering if she
just
wants
to maintain them in a greenhouse.
Start them indoors.
And that's different than trying to grow them as a houseplant.
Okay,
because long-term,
so what if she's starting them indoors?
If you're starting them indoors, it's fine. You could start them under grow lights if you don't have a greenhouse situation. And so you would just put them in to the flats and put them under grow lights for 6 or 8 weeks and then bring them outside. But long term, they are not going to be a house plant.
Okay, next person's asking about a product I've never heard of, Acelaprin, to control bill bugs. When would they apply that?
Nice
South
pronunciation.
Jordan?
That one's not easy.
It was a guess.
They can get it down anytime by mid to late April. It's in Scott's Grub X.
Oh, okay. Next person wants to know if tulip bulbs can be planted now for next year.
No, not really. If you didn't get them in, you can try planting them and see if they form leaves, and then next year they will form a flower, but they may or may not form leaves at this point.
For next year?
For next year. They could be dead.
Well, they might not be.
They might not. So I'd plant them.
Okay, this is some, I planted some too. So I'm
wondering. I would plant them and just see if they form leaves. Are yours forming leaves?
No.
So,
but I just planted them.
That's all you can do is see if they form leaves. And
I just figured it was better than just throwing them out.
And so it's always a risk. You know, Mike would say, oh, chuck them and just buy them again. But Mike, I'm a little more conservative. I'm like, oh, give it a try.
Me too. Give it a try. What can you lose? They don't come up, right? We're going to take a break, come back with more of your calls and questions. Our phone lines are open for the last 15 minutes of the show here. You can call us at 801-575-8255. You can also text us at 57500. Thank you for spending your Saturday morning with the KSL Greenhouse. Maria and Ton with you, taking your calls and questions. Next texter, Ton, has three very large mulberry trees in their front yard. They're 30 to 40 feet high. They're pretty much tearing up the lawn, with some of the roots actually 3 or 4 inches above the grass at this point. They are wondering if they can put 3 to 4 inches of soil over that and then maybe resod. Is there any sort of solution? They like the shade from the trees, but they don't like it tearing up the yard.
This is the problem with fast-growing shade trees, is they have a lot of surface roots. Mulberries,
they just cut it out? Will that kill the tree?
It will damage the trees and make them less stable. And so the best I could tell them to do is to go out 6 or 7 feet in any direction from the trunk and just put bark mulch down. Don't put weed fabric, but just bark mulch, and just sacrifice those areas for the tree trunks as for those surface roots. But even 10, 15 feet from the tree, you can get some surface roots under the mulberries. But of fast growing trees, the mulberries are some of the least offensive of them, I guess.
Wow. Next person wants to know when you should remove the white tree wrap on new trees.
Now is fine. They should be, if they're new trees, they should be wrapped in the fall, sometime late October, early November, and then that wrap should come off sometime mid to late March.
Okay, next person wants to know, are there any secrets to planting, is it barefoot or bare root red cedars?
Bare root.
Autocorrect got me, too. They tried potting soil last year and lost half of what they planted. They're trying again, putting in 1 gallon containers. Plants are about 12 inches tall.
I wish we had a call so I could be a little bit more specific, but usually if half of them died, it was probably because they dried out. Mm. It is really hard to keep those outdoors in gallon cans sufficiently watered. They would need to water them daily.
Okay.
And it's just something that it's not as easy as it seems. And that's why at the garden center, a 1 gallon finished arborvita, which is another name for red cedar, a finished arborvita in a gallon can cost you $10 or $12 because of the difficulty of keeping them watered and things.
Next person wants to know, when should they prune their grapes?
Sometime now, between now and mid-April. I think Mike Caron, our grape specialist, started his last week.
Okay. Daniel's on the line in West Jordan. Good morning, Daniel. What was your question?
Hi. I'd like to find out what to do with... I've got an old lilac. It's probably 30, 40 years old. And I need to prune it, but I've got a lot of dead wood. We just moved in. I got to prune the dead out, but it's just everywhere, and it's also covered in ivy, and I got to get rid of the ivy, and I'm not sure how to do both.
Well, I mean, you do have the option of just getting a chainsaw out, cutting it 18 inches above the ground, and letting it regrow. It won't flower for 3 or 4 years, but that is an option, and that would get rid of the ivy. Now, if the ivy has seeded inside of it, then that's a different issue.
We've got ivy all over in that section.
Do you find rooted ivy inside the bush?
Yes.
So this is going to be difficult because that ivy, you're going to have to pull the vines off of the branches, but not sever them from the ground and clip mm-hmm. them and just get a little paintbrush with a bottle of concentrated Roundup or Kills All. And when you clip those, you just dab the very end. Now that will stay in the roots and won't get into the soil, but that's the only way you're going to get that ivy out of the lilac if it is rooted into the ground and is growing up through.
It is. Oh boy. Okay.
All right, Daniel.
Well, good to know. Thank you.
Good luck on that. Next listener is Jada. Jada wants to know how you get rid of grape hyacinths and infestation of it. She said, what's the most effective way to keep them from coming back? And is it best to do it before they bloom?
Yeah, it is. But anytime you can go after them, there's one spray, I think Image All-in-One Lawn Weed Killer. I would need to check the label again, but it may only have the Star of Bethlehem and Allium, like the wild onion and mm-hmm. wild garlic on it, but it may. I would need to look at the label to see if the grape hyacinth's on there. Thinking about it, it may not be. But if you can clip them or mow them so that you have half the stem gone or the leaves, as soon as you do that, you can spray Roundup over the top and see if that will get rid of them.
Okay, Barbara's on the line in Mill Creek. Good morning, Barbara. What was your question?
Good morning. I'm doing my annual white tops bindweed. I've been working on it for 5 years, so I'm slowly getting it done. But now I have white tops that are underneath some aspen trees and some other trees where don't get much water, so I usually kind of leave it alone. But if I try to, let me back up. If I try to use what you told me to put on the bindweed, it's not getting the white tops. It kills the plant, but it doesn't kill the roots very well. So we're thinking maybe Roundup.
And if there isn't grass under there, Roundup does such a good job on white top.
Okay, and it won't hurt the trees at all?
Try not to spray the trunks, but no, it won't. And then I would use a surfactant or a spreader sticker with the Roundup or the Kills All, whatever you're using. They both have glyphosate in it. But use that spreader sticker, but Roundup does a fabulous job against white top.
Okay. And then we're trying to also put in a new lawn because the bindweed had taken out too much of the lawn. And so we're redoing the irrigation and all that. And we think we have it, but bindweed, you don't really know whether it's come until it's too late. So if the white top and the bindweed come up in a grass mix, is it going to overtake the babies?
It can. So I would recommend, as soon as you've mowed a couple times, read instructions, but that Image All-in-One Lawn Weed Killer would help. But eventually I would switch over if you kill the bindweed and it's just the white top, I would go toward like Ortho Weed Be Gone Max or Speed Zone or something and see if you can control the white top that way in the lawn.
Okay, squeezing one more question in there. If it keeps raining, will it wash away the pre-emergent?
No, it won't. The pre-emergent stays in place as long as you're not on a slope and the soil isn't washing.
Well, thanks so much for listening today to the KSL Greenhouse. I'm afraid that we are out of time, keeping some folks hanging. If you didn't catch us earlier, you can catch us on podcast at kslpodcast.com. You can hear the entire show. And the plant of the week this morning was the dwarf iris. And you can see and read more about the dwarf iris on the KSL Greenhouse Facebook page, as well as all of our other features that we covered this morning. I'm going to go plant some trees, Ton. You're headed out for a little trip.
Yep, taking the family to Universal Studios, so it's spring break.
All right. Next week, we do have a short show due to LDS conference coverage, so make sure you tune in early. We'll join you from 8 to 9:30 next week. Have a great weekend.